Lee and her partner are your typical millennial couple from Toronto. Richard Florida might say that they're part of the creative class. They were recently looking for a new place to live, but when Lee started scanning the options, she was looking at more than just monthly rent or sticker price.
When my partner and I were looking at places, we set kind of our budget for a place and started to look. And initially we had thought maybe we couldn't afford to live in downtown. But once we realized that the cost of taking the TTC every day would cost us almost $300 a month, we realized that if we lived closer to work and were able to walk, then we could spend more on rent because we wouldn't have to factor in the cost of transit every day.
She was considering other factors, things like convenience and quality of life. Really, she was factoring in quality of life as much as cost.
So I live in one of the few carless condos in downtown Toronto. I haven't ever owned a car, so I have bike. There's a lot of bike storage in my building, so I can use my bike when I want to get around as well. And then I also have access to car share, so whenever we need to have a car, we can grab one without having to pay for the cost of storing it in a building every single day.
For Lee, the freedom of being able to walk places without thinking about transit or parking was really important, liberating even.
I like being able to walk everywhere. I find that I go out and do more after work because I don't have to go home first or carry my stuff with me kind of all day. I can go home and then kind of head out on foot again anytime I want.
The couple's values and the market realities they face are becoming more and more common among millennials, and it may be impacting the way our cities are developing. Places where cafes spread like wildfire, and smartphones and Instagram followers have more currency than the car you don't drive. Marcus Moose is a registered professional planner and professor at the University of Waterloo. He's noticed major demographic shifts happening in our cities.
We generally know now a decrease in household size, and so a lot of young adults are living longer on their own than previous generations have done. So that sort of increases demand for smaller housing units. But interestingly enough, too, with sort of some difficulty in the economy, there's also more young adults, again, that are moving back home during various parts of their lives. And so, you know, one implication, this is a bit of a hypothesis, would be to say, well, then, you know, parents, baby boomers in many cases, might be less likely to downsize into smaller units, partly because they expect their young adult children potentially to come home again during parts of their 20s, and they may wait longer to downsize until they're sort of sure.
The decision of many millennials to move downtown is changing the face and market of our cities. It's also changing the way we zone. So say a young person was deciding where to live. Let's call this theoretical person Peter, last name Pan. What would be impacting their decisions?
So Peter's kind of thinking about unit size because he would have a smaller household today than an equivalent age one or two generations ago. He would have perhaps less certainty in whether his job was going to be long-term and more likely to be on a contract or in a part-time position. So there's also potential for him to think more about wanting to rent as opposed to own. And in fact, the bank may not give him a loan if he can't demonstrate sort of a permanent income stream. And he may also be more likely to be living with friends, roommates, again, an economic component to that. There's also a lifestyle component to that. A lot of people want to live in neighborhoods where there are other young people, and you get all, you know, the lifestyle amenities around that. So there's a lot more to it, but certainly some of those things are things we have to keep in mind when we're thinking about.
So what is driving zoning? Is it policy, demographics, market? Smart growth, transportation?
I think we have to recognize that people make their decisions within an existing structure of the city, right? An existing housing market. I could demand a particular housing form all I want, but it's not necessarily going to appear overnight.
So how can planners do more than respond? Work is becoming less structured. More people are working from home. We have more flexible hours. Housing has become more expensive relative to most people's incomes. People are more transient and more likely to rent than a generation ago. How can zoning respond to these changes? How can it be flexible but proactive? In this episode, we're looking at trends in zoning. So no zoning out.
I'm Ross Sauer.
And I'm Danielle Davis. And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories. This is an Ontario Professional Planners Institute episode. OPPI is the recognized voice of the province's planning profession. There are more than 4,000 members work in government, private practice, universities, and not-for-profit agencies in the fields of urban and rural development, community design, social services, heritage conservation, housing, economic development, and more. So in order to get more density in our city boundaries to accommodate these demographic shifts, we need to rezone areas for intensification.
Right. The I word. We caught up with Ted Faubert, a registered professional planner, to hear his story of trying to add density along a corridor in an established urban neighborhood in Ottawa. The city of Ottawa has targeted transit nodes and main streets as areas for intensification, but there were a lot of roadblocks as the city tried to increase density through rezoning.
In the mid-80s, I was a manager of policy planning at the City of Ottawa. Mm-hmm. We prepared the first official plan for the city. And we were not allowed publicly to use the word intensification. So that has changed dramatically over the years. Now the current policy direction is really focused on intensifying our city, not growing out, but growing in.
So what constitutes intensification? And what are the considerations for planners in approaching these projects?
There's different levels of intensification, different levels of infill, whether it's a semi-detached on a large lot that once had a single, or whether you're putting an apartment building on a lot that's adjacent to a main street. Or again, it's policy driven. The intent is really to try to protect for this scale and the existing character of neighborhoods, as opposed to impose on them change that is inappropriate or out of scale with the development, and to push the higher dense zoning to the edges of the community, which is the main streets.
Ted describes how policy sets the general range of density, but ultimately the final site density and height, for that matter, is really determined through rezoning. But each site is different, making it tough to establish a blanket zoning. Zoning needs to respond to the conditions of the site and the character of the neighborhood.
The focus is really on design. Mm. The regulatory side of it is a legislative requirement, of course, but it's really more about good placemaking.
So that's the theory, but how does intensification work in practice? Ted shares a project from Ottawa, a main street intensification project.
That land was designated in the official plan as a traditional main street, mm-hmm. to put stores on the street and transport mixed-use development. Mm-hmm. That piece of land was zoned industrially.
So the 10-acre site needed to be rezoned from industrial to a use that reflected the mixed-use main street that was envisioned by the policy. The area was designated traditional main street, and the Loblaws grocery store was the first project to seek rezoning under the new policy direction.
At the time, Richmond Road was virtually, I wouldn't say dead, but it really was not lively at all. Mm-hmm. There was tremendous areas of inactivity, car washes, gas stations. I know the 10 years prior to the approval of the Loblaws development, I heard a statistic, and I don't know if it's accurate, but 90% of the businesses turned over in that 10-year horizon, which wouldn't surprise mm-hmm. me.
But even when the policy is there, rezoning isn't easy. In fact, communities are often very resistant to rezoning.
That was a huge fight, actually, mm-hmm. in the community. Mm-hmm. There was strong opposition to that development coming from the community. Mm-hmm. It felt the store was too big, felt the traffic was going to be a disaster.
It took almost 4 years for the project to get approval. The community was concerned about the scale of the project, the idea of having a big box development, and the amount of traffic it would generate.
The community basically felt that the store should be smaller. Mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily mind a retail store at that location, but they felt it should be smaller. The store itself is about 100,000 square feet, mm-hmm. so it's a call a mid-box. Mm-hmm. And the concern was it was inappropriate in terms of the scale. Mm-hmm. It was inappropriate because it was going to generate all this infiltrated traffic. Mm-hmm.
So, Loblaws and the city had to work together to create a zone that would respond to the community's concerns, minimizing the visual impact of parking and traffic on the main street, and coming up with a building design that would respect the idea of an urban village and not feel like a big box store.
The concern really was predominantly traffic, or people didn't like big box stores. Mm-hmm. What Loblaws did and had to do to get approval from the municipality was to make it an urban store, mm-hmm. to push the development to the edge of the street, to the mm-hmm. edge of Richmond Road, put all the parking in the back, mm-hmm. Make it pedestrian friendly, mm-hmm. make it scale so it fit the community, notwithstanding mm-hmm. the fact that it's a large store. Mm-hmm. And on that basis,
the rezoning had to reconcile the developer's interests with the community interests. The project needed the density to be viable, but without community support, the project might not go through. The rezoning would set a precedent for future redevelopment sites on Richmond Road.
Loblaws development really created an anchor retail use in that community. That, in combination with the MEC, really created the anchor to solidify the retail restaurant uses along that street. Mm-hmm. That, in combination with intensification, more and more people living mm-hmm. in the community, mm-hmm. Has really strengthened that street. Mm-hmm. I think most people would agree it's probably one of the more vibrant mm-hmm. Locations in the city.
Trying to make development that's sensitive to the needs of community and avoiding community conflicts is no easy task. But making zoning more comprehensive and assertive seems like it could be a good first step. One of the things that Marcus touched on is the importance of flexibility and the challenges of zoning and policy when they're forced to react to the market. Is our zoning simply reacting? Or are we reshaping our cities and planning processes to reflect the shift taking place?
We shouldn't just let individual people decide what every property looks like. And I think that's very consistent with actually the values of the planning profession. But we can't do that if that completely stifles creativity and change, right? Because cities change and they do need to change to adapt to society. So I don't have a specific mechanism to prescribe, so to speak. But I think, municipalities need to be thinking about that in conjunction with the province, because some of this may actually require changes or new enabling legislation that we haven't thought about at this point. And so, sometimes that's seen as I have to sort of out to say, I'm an academic, I can think in these broad terms, but I think it's probably some of these broad discussions we need to have initially, because if we don't, we're just going to be tweaking some individual mechanisms or pricing something with another mechanism that has its own problems. But why not have the higher level conversation first and kind of consider what are all the options out there? And we may come up with something that, you know, that's not even on our radar right now.
He sees the importance of finding a way to get a density and amenities that could provide walkability and livability without forcing families to leave our cities. That phenomena of families having to leave inner cities is what some scholars call the missing middle.
Planning, in my view, hasn't really been proactive in saying we want denser communities. In my view, planning has been kind of accommodating a demographic transition. But generally speaking, it's fairly low density stuff, and then it's the really high density stuff. And we haven't really zoned appropriately, I would say, and put other development mechanisms in place or planning mechanisms in place to facilitate more sort of medium density neighborhoods where, you know, you're still getting a density that would allow you to probably provide transit in a meaningful way. You'd get some walkability, but you're not doing it at such a high density that that you're getting these really small units that you're actually effectively pricing larger families out of the neighborhoods.
So what are some of the new trends in zoning that can help planners on their quest to achieve this walkable and livable mid-density that seems to be a golden goose?
The government's trying to create more types of zoning authorities together with site plan to allow municipalities to use those to do better sort of community level planning in a more holistic way than what we'd seen previously with zoning.
That's our friend Victor Doyle from the province again, also a registered professional planner. By creating more detailed plans with the community, it's easy to establish the needs and wants of a neighborhood. Then, planners and politicians are better equipped to work with developers and negotiate community benefits or amenities when development comes forward.
So I forgot to mention, in the 1983 Act, one of the other changes they brought forward was what's called density bonusing. So in return for granting increased height or density to a developer, the municipality could ask for community benefits in return. A daycare center, a connection to a subway, public art, recreational space in a building perhaps, sometimes affordable housing units. But that was in exchange for the increase in height and density.
Bonus zoning, Section 37 of the Planning Act, and affectionately known simply as Section 37 by many Ontario planners, can be a useful tool to get important community infrastructure. But it requires partnership with the community and developer. Take the case of Wabash. Kathy Allen is with the Wabash Building Society, a group that relied on Section 37 for upgrading their park and its facilities.
Of course, we had big plans. We wanted to develop the big community center, this Lindsay Doyle factory building on the property, and we wanted it to become a community center. And it's, back then it was $10 million, now it's $30 million, but it was too big a project, and we were too low, especially after amalgamation, in terms of priority for planners. So we kept getting bumped down and a little bit discouraged. So I must put the credit to Doug Bennett, our chair, our current still chair, well, actually just stepped down chair, who said, let's start with a baby step.
So the community group approached their counselor and started the negotiations of bonus density.
Let's start a baby step. Let's try and retrofit the field house. One of the things, now that the Sorrento Park is being animated and there's soccer games and baseball and we're right across from George William, the Little Tot playground, we need washrooms. Kids are peeing behind the bushes. So, and there was a lot of turnover. This, when I moved in 92, was seniors, really huge portion of the population. And I think now we're one of the highest density of under fives in Canada in this ward. So it's huge difference in our population use and the park as well. So in 2006, 7, 8, we held buy a brick campaigns, and every family spent $100 to buy a brick, because we understood, especially from our councillor and politicians, that the more local support we could garner and petitions and voices, the better it would be for the city to then come in and help us renovate and rehabilitate the building, because the whole building retrofit and opening with washrooms and a little kitchen was $350,000. We had no hopes of raising $350,000. So the city said, okay, well, you start. And so we had $20,000 raised in the first campaign, Vibrant campaign, from local families, 200 families, or 200 families, $100. So that started the serious discussions. Okay, now the city was coming aboard the same time the Robert Watson Lofts on Sororan were being developed. So we Wabash directors met with the developers personally to talk about the benefits of the park, and the developer, I guess, has some ability to designate which local issue they want to support with their Section 37 money. So understanding that our densities are going up and they wanted to build more than was permitted in Section 34, they said, okay, our Section 37 will come to you. So it was a very clear agreement. $200,000 from Robert Watson Block Lofts came to Sororan Park Fieldhouse.
Wabash is a great example of how an organized community can court a developer and ensure that a community amenity contribution is directed towards their project when a rezoning comes forward. In the case of Wabash, the Fieldhouse project was jump-started by the Robert Watson Lofts and its $200,000 contribution when they went to the planners for a rezoning. But what happens for bigger projects that can't be fully financed by Section 37, like Wabash's community center? What if there are no new developments looking for a rezoning and extra density from the city? Can community investment only come with development?
Do you have to have density in order to have proportional recreation resources for your population? I've worked in the charitable sector for the last 30 years. I work for South Parkdale charity that serves the people there, and 40% live below the poverty line. What kind of park do they have? What kind of organizing voice do they have? I'm not saying this is fair. I'm saying this is how it worked, and I do believe it's a good outcome, but I'm not saying I support the system behind it.
Density bonusing is not the most sustainable way to build the community infrastructure that we need. There seems to be a lot of talk these days about something called the development permit system. Maybe that could help us be more proactive. The development permit system, or DPS, establishes clear and predictable rules for development that aligns with a community plan. It secures community benefits up front, as opposed to having to negotiate each time. Victor Doyle explains how it's different from zoning.
It's based on a community vision for an area. It's not based on zoning for a particular site or one side of the street or something like that. So it really allows the community to get involved in creating the vision in terms of the types of uses, the general heights and massing and density that's going to be in a neighborhood.
It also allows for a fair bit of flexibility in the types of uses.
Zoning bylaws are historically very rigid. You can have A, B, and C. Development permit system says you can have A, B, C, but you could also probably have D, E, and F if you met certain criteria. So if you wanted, let's say, a restaurant, potentially you previously might have had to apply for a rezoning, but this would say you can have all the uses plus a restaurant, but you have to do a study that shows how you're going to provide enough parking for the restaurant patrons.
It also allows a range in standards in terms of building heights, setbacks, parking, and these are also linked to criteria.
So you could potentially have a higher building if you can demonstrate that you're not going to put the other side of the street in shade for over a certain amount of time, back to my previous example.
It allows a municipality to impose conditions.
And if you recall when I said earlier, municipalities often required a rezoning so they could actually impose conditions on a developer, even though they didn't really have the authority to do so. So the development permit system allows that authority expressly to place conditions. And a good example of this is with respect to urban design guidelines cultural heritage guidelines, conservation heritage district guidelines, which are documents municipalities prepare, but they don't have any statutory basis. So often they'll get ignored by developers and or the Ontario Municipal Board. A municipality under development permits could say one of the conditions of your development is you have to meet our urban design guidelines. And thereby, they've just elevated those guidelines to having a statutory status, if you will. And so it's a really, really important and beneficial tool for municipalities, and it allows them to get into all those design questions that zoning really was never able to do because it's too rigid a process.
So what are the mechanics of a DPS? How does it help to reduce conflict with the community?
So you place it over an area, and then any development proposal that comes forward is required to obtain a development permit. And provided they meet all the requirements of the development permit bylaw, they get to go forward and obtain that permit. And this is an important point because the development permit system says you set out the vision for the community or the area ahead of time, and that can be appealed to the Ontario Municipal Board. But once that's approved, development proponents cannot apply to change that, the provision. So if it was 20 stories, they can't come back in with an application for 24 stories. And so it's a bit of a quid pro quo. By agreeing to the vision up front, the neighbors give up the ability to appeal site-specific projects, but the developers have to meet the rules. And this is a good way, we think, of reducing a lot of the conflicts we see when individual proposals come forward and every application is bigger and higher than the one before.
Victor Doyle paints the picture of a shift in the way planners may be regulating development and controlling land use in the future. DPS, if used effectively, could help communities like Wabash get their parks and community centers. Developers like the ones TED work on to get their density, and municipalities like Ottawa and Toronto to get quality projects completed faster.
Like Marcus talked about, it requires the planner and the community to establish the vision and public interest early on in the process.
Zoning is moving from restrictive and rigid to holistic, dynamic, and broad. Instead of zoning in, it's zoning out.
You have been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast, bringing the city to life with stories. This was an OPPI episode. It was created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordy Gordon, Joel Sajunki, and me, Ross Soward. And a very special thank you to our talented musical artists, Eloquent and Shad, who lent us their great songs. For more Cities Alive, check out Cities Alive on iTunes or stream Cities Alive at pdcenter.ca.